Danilana Kitchen talks about food. Danilana Kitchen talks recipes. Danilana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Danilana Kitchen. On a cold winter day here in central Iowa, we're coming to you from the fine studios of KHOI FM 89.1 in beautiful downtown Ames. This is the Danilana Kitchen. We get together once a week, talk about food, farming, recipes, advice, opinions. We have a fine old time around the kitchen table here. Welcome. This is community radio, and we get by with a lot of help from all of you, including support comes from Wheatsfield Co-op, your full-service natural foods grocery in Ames. Community-owned and community-focused since 1974, open daily, 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. Located downtown at 413 Northwestern, just off Main Street in Ames, everyone can shop. Wheatsfield Co-op. Last week on the Danilana Kitchen, we talked about soup. Good time of year for soup. Also, good time of year for positive New Year's resolutions, healthy eating, and being mindful about taking care of ourselves. Today on the Danilana Kitchen, Donna Prisgintis sends us some thoughts on bone broth. And thinking warmer thoughts of spring, summer, and the great outdoors, we'll hear an encore interview with Mark Edwards about living and loving the Iowa land. And some information about sea berries, a perennial shrub worth getting to know. Last spring, I planted some on my farm, and the last I looked, the plants were still going strong. Cold this time of year, but they're still there. Looking forward to see what happens when things finally melt in the spring. It's always good to try something new. Soup, stock, bone broth. Donna Prisgintis, my able co-host here on the Danilana Kitchen, sends these thoughts from New Zealand about what's going on in her kitchen.
Okay, hello, this is Donna from sunny and lovely Tauranga, New Zealand. So while you guys are battling winter, I am enjoying plenty of vitamin D down here. But one thing we're probably doing in common is it's the new year, the whole world over, and doing a little bit of cleaning up of our diet after the excesses of the holidays. So I'm making a big pot of chicken stock. That's my standard nourishment. And as we've said before, Lana and I both talked about often about our chicken stock recipes. I think it's even posted on the website. But it's basically save all the bones from the carcass, throw them in the pot, Boil, but not really boil, just simmer so that there's just a few bubbles popping up in it, you know. So really, it's a long simmer with just a couple bay leaves. That's all I put in, bones and bay leaves. Crockpot is good. Save those chicken bones or turkey bones or whatever little fowl you're having. The same thing can be said for beef broth, which is another big favorite of mine. I just take the bones, roast them at a high temperature in the oven first. Then I put them in the water. I like to cook anywhere from 12 to 24 hours. That really, really extracts all the minerals from the bones and melts the collagen down and makes it so nourishing and delicious and thicker. Now, there are lots of ways. I think the distinction between stock and bone broth has more to do with the length of time, if there is really and truly any distinction, the length of time. But what people are calling bone broth now, because that's the popular phrase of the moment, is something that's been cooked a long time, at least 12 hours, whereas a stock could be like a shorter, lighter cook. But when we're going for the nutrient density, probably those long, slow simmers are the best. So we're talking about stock, which is a key component in three of the five mother sauces of the classical French cuisine. Escoffier, the master chef of over 100 years ago, claimed in his Le Guide Culinaire, the culinary guide, he says, indeed, stock is everything in cooking. Without it, nothing can be done. And I would certainly agree. I think often the difference in what we're calling a white tablecloth restaurant, which would be your more high-end restaurant, as compared to more popular, less sophisticated places, is the way a good restaurant will use homemade stocks. Whereas a lot of restaurants just use these powdered forms that come in little jars, and you can taste the difference. So, and for home, I would really recommend just making your own stock, having it in the fridge or keeping it in the freezer. It says here that while other chefs were throwing away the tender scraps and bones, Escoffier was simmering them into liquid gold. So now it's become very popular. Once again, these things have gone around. I was reading about a restaurant opened in New York called Brodo, which is the Italian word for a broth. And this restaurant, Brodo, has a humble takeout window attached to the main restaurant called Hearth. And it's selling 24-hour to 48-hour simmered broths. And the chef claims the superfood that never made it onto the list of superfoods. That's what he's saying. And folks, he's charging $10 for a mug of it. There's another restaurant in New York, Morgan Stern's Finest Ice Cream, and they have collaborated to make a sweet bone broth beverage that offers a mostly guilt-free excuse to indulge in hot chocolate. The dairy and gluten-free, oh boy, gingered beef broth elixir is flavored with 100% chocolate and steamed coconut milk. That's stretching it, but, you know, it probably tastes good. And if the chocolate and the beef don't strike your fancy, they also have a smooth and creamy Brodo concoction with a touch of nutmeg and a little chicken bone broth. Their beverage, they're calling it an eggnog. So let's get cooking our own bone broth in Iowa. I think the plain and the simple, you know, I like beef stock. I don't strain my stocks. I mean, I strain the big bones out. But like with the beef stock, I actually, after I've cooked it for hours and hours and hours, I actually just, because the bones are so large, I just cool it enough to lift them out, and I take the bones out by hand. And then I leave all the little nuggy bits in it. You can, however, strain it if you don't like the little nuggy bits. Some people think they're yucky, but I think they're delicious. And then often what I do is I will take the stock and then boil some brown rice and make congee. Now, congee is a sort of it's a Hong Kong dish. And I believe we've talked about this before. It's really, it's the most nourishing, hearty, warm thing to fill your stomach with in the winter. Now, in China, of course, they cook it with white rice, but you're cooking the rice down into the homemade broth. And it can be chicken or beef or pork broth, and then you cook the rice for a long time, like an hour maybe, until it's really, really soft, almost like an oatmeal texture. And then everybody at the table can have their broth-based congee bowl, and they can pick condiments, so a little scallions, a little coriander maybe, certainly bacon is yummy in it, or bits of fried pork, or a little beef or pieces of chicken, you know, maybe some quick sautéed vegetables. Kind of, it's like a make-your-own-at-the-table dish. Or they're saying, here, I'll read you a little more of this article from Tasting Table. The chef is saying that good ingredients are the base of every great broth. It is important for flavor, but also for quality. We believe in the holistic management of animals, and that not only creates better tasting proteins, but it's much better for the animals and the land. After all, the broth is all about the bones, so buy high quality ones. More often than not, he says, you can find them on the cheap or even for free if you call and ask your butcher or fishmonger. Oh yeah, don't forget about the fish broths. You know, the Japanese fish broths are called dashi, and they're used for almost everything with ramen and miso and all of that sort of thing. And you can use fish bones and then, you know, boil in some seaweeds and kelps and bonito, which is a dried shaved fish flakes. I know you can buy those bonito flakes and seaweeds they have at Wheat's Fields. For bones and Ames, you know, I would ask at the butcher counters in all of the, wherever you like to shop, or perhaps up at the Story City locker, they would be saving bones for you. It's something that a lot of meat processors just throw out because they don't have demand for it. But with the high-quality products that we're getting, certainly in pork and beef, let's start having a little public demand for these little pieces that waste not, want not. You know, let's eat our bone broth. We'll all be healthier and happier for it. So that's my New Year's tip. Let's go for the bone broth. They do sell prepackaged bone broths, you know, in little aseptic containers. I've tried them, and I don't really like the flavor. There's nothing like just a real bone broth. And even though it does take a long time, it's fairly stress-free. You know, you just put it in and boil it. So let's go for it. That's a really good thing to do in the New Year's, and we'll be feeling really good. It'll warm up your tummy right now.
Ah, warm tummies. Recently, I enjoyed another fine manifestation of a good bone broth. This is a beef bone broth. Donna talked about congee, and this is sort of a related sort of thing. A friend of mine recently made a fine pot of pho. For years, I called this pho, but it's pho, because it is a Southeast Asian, Vietnamese sort of thing. That's pho, P-H-O, P-H-O. And because it's from Vietnam, one has to remember to make it a rising inflection at the end, because heaven knows, if you say pho differently, it turns into something else. But look for this as in recipe books. It's P-H-O, pho. It's a wonderful, wonderful bone broth. This is the Vietnamese equivalent of chicken soup, and one of the most celebrated. The fragrant stock is infused with cinnamon and anise and ginger and really soothing, soothing spices. It like the congee, it's sort of made up at the table, because you are served a wonderful noodle dish here, and with a wonderful bone broth at its base. And it has shallots and ginger and pepper and lots of rice stick noodles in it. And garnishes are often part of this, with cilantro and basil and a squirt of lime. It's really fine, really fine. I'd recommend a book called Asian Noodles by Nina Simmons, S-I-M-O-N-D-S. That's got the pho recipe that I use. It's pretty good. It's pretty good. Give it a try. Just like Donna and Chef Escoffier say, a good broth is the start of many good things in the kitchen. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen on KHOI 89.1. Go to KHOIFM.org. Go to the talk section, go to the Donna Lana Kitchen tab there and find past shows, recipes. Find out more about us. This is community radio. On that same website, you'll find streaming, you can podcast. You can contact us with advice, opinions, recipes by contacting us at khoiradio@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. Put Donna Lana Kitchen in the subject line. Support this fine radio station. Visit that website and hit that donate button. We are all in this together. Now, let's turn our attention to the great Iowa outdoors. Donna and I talked with Mark Edwards last spring, so let's listen again. He talks about his involvement with Iowa nature, Iowa land, water, plants, and animals. Talks about Ledges State Park, the Trails Program, mushrooms, Sweet Sicily, the Lesser Scalp Duck, and the importance of our place in the ecosystem. We really are all in this together. Joining us on the Donna Lana Kitchen today is Mark Edwards. He's from Boone, Iowa, has worked for the Iowa Conservation Commission for a long time, and is retired from the Iowa Department of Natural Resources, where his work included initiating the Department of Natural Resources Trails Program here in this state. So, welcome, Mark.
Well, good morning.
What have you learned in your time in the great Iowa outdoors?
I mean, when I start learning where I live and everything, but it...
And loving where you live.
And loving where I live. There's the big part that actually it's made me pretty happy, even when you see how dark things look out there. But in 1980, I read a small little article in the Wapsipinicon Journal, and it talked about junk land, and it started talking about
Iowa. Junk land.
And that... You know, what we have is junk land, and yet we're going to always put a road through it or something. It was talking about the different controversies within communities of running a road through these little places.
What is junk land? Is that like the garbage dump or something?
Well, you have to start from realizing that Iowa, you know, originally we cultivated 95% of it. So it's the most biologically altered state in North America. So I think we kind of look at it, you know, we're leading the past, and now we need to talk from that about looking to the future. One way to understand that, I think, is for the local listeners, say we could talk about Ledges State Park is one specific example, and I can show you pictures where there's not a tree left in that park, hardly. It was completely logged for railroad ties to build the railroad going west.
How long ago?
That was right in the early 1900s. It became a park. It started to become a park in 1927, so by that point it was already logged. It had been heavily grazed. I have a postcard that I found in an antique store talking about people are there and a cow rolls off the hill and falls off the cliff. And sheep grazed, mined. You know, we made good use of that area. And we did that to the whole state. And so out of that, the pieces that were left or that people thought deserved some kind of protection, that's what started the state park system, for example. So by 1934, we led the nation in the establishment of state parks because we had already changed the landscape so much that we knew we had to take care of these last little pieces.
But aren't we kind of low on the percentage of lands that are actually in state parks?
Yeah, we're fighting over the bottom here right now. And
all the states, we have some of the smallest amount of state
parks. Yes, you could take all the state parks in Iowa and all the state preserves and put them all together in one place. You have something about 9 miles on a square. Out of 36 million acres,
That's something to think about. Boy, were we ever doing good. Trouble is those things that are set aside are not like in the city of Des Moines or all on 9 miles on a side. They're kind of scattered.
Yeah, very scattered, so much so that they can't maintain their biological diversity.
Right, like postage stamp sized pieces
absolutely.
Of prairie remnant.
Forest, we saved them for different reasons. Each park kind of had its own reason of why we saved it. So Ledges, for example, for your local listeners, had a juniper moss reindeer lichen habitat there, which is a northern plants, which have held on this far south. So it's really rare to see these, and they cover those north-facing slopes and the ledges.
And that is still there?
That is still there. There's still remnants of that left.
Reindeer like it. Who would have thought?
Yeah. No, and they mean reindeer from way up north.
That's
what they eat. Well, we used to have elk, actually. We probably had more elk than buffalo, but, in this part.
Do we have any elk left?
There was a herd that escaped from up in northeast Iowa from a elk farm, and there was a lot of controversy at that because then they came in and killed them because they didn't want the spread of disease.
Speaking of landscape, I mean, there are animals that are now living their lives in confinement for our convenience, but the Iowa used to be full of animals that were doing things just for Iowa's convenience.
Oh, to read the journals of the first people here walking across the backs of fish across the water.
Yeah.
The plentiful food sources that are here. And you look at how long cultures were here, 10,000, 12,000 years, they didn't seem to be struggling.
They weren't
struggling. They were building mounds, doing lots of cultural events that they must have had a lot of free time.
I saw this
well put.
This film recently, where they've gone in to track the and the wildlife regrowth in the Chernobyl area?
Yes.
Because all of a sudden they have a large area where no human beings live, and the wildlife has rebounded tremendously.
Oh, yeah.
If we weren't mucking about with them.
Sure. Well, I think we could look at that in Iowa. You know, there wasn't – I mean, I read these accounts where people would see a deer and it would spread through the community so fast that someone had seen a deer. Like that was the rarest thing in the world.
It's
and
true.
Now you're swerving your car around them. You know, so.
Do the deer have no predators left? What about coyotes?
No, not coyotes. Disease is predation on them. But people, I'm trying to remember the numbers. I think it's 200,000 a year that we harvest. I love that word. There's a lot of corn
meat. We do it well.
Speaking of corn, you wrote an article, and the title was Behind the Corn Curtain, A World of Wounds. I thought that was kind of an interesting title, and I have to read this little quote from it. Why is this state advertised as feeding the world when we have to import 86% of what we eat and it travels an average of 1,500 miles to get here? We want the facts to fit how we picture this state, and when they don't, we ignore the facts. I thought that was very well put. Do you want to comment on how you
Well, I read the other day that a quote, and it was saying 90% and 2,000 miles. So I might have underestimated. But I think it brings up the discussion between agriculture in this state and how we live, how people relate and have their needs met and what they eat, where they are. And
yes, because, of course, we are busy, quote, feeding the world here.
Yeah. And in one sense, you know, the things that we're growing, we're exporting those more and more. And that's essentially what's sustaining the economy. And so now with the California drought going on, you know, we're going to have to reevaluate where we get our vegetables from. Expanding. I've been gardening forever, and I've been expanding my garden and putting up.
It's interesting to talk about the economy. We think of the economy as cash-based. But when it comes to survival, feeding ourselves, having health and good communities, it's funny. We don't seem to put a dollar figure on that. So it gets kind of shuffled away. And it's we have to consider what an economy, what home security really is.
Well, I just read one the other day, and I don't know if you've said this on there or not, but I think Iowa now ranks fourth in the nation in terms of farmers markets. And I thought that's ironic. You know, you're sitting in an agricultural state, and we're quickly moving that. I mean, with organic foods, we're quickly understanding, you know, we can't continue in the system we've had. Yeah. So that was kind of exciting. At least, you know, we're fourth.
That has changed amazingly, and my heart is gladdened by the fact that there are so many more people that are really willing to take on the hard work and responsibility, and there are more farmers doing small-scale vegetable feed people kind of farmers.
Yes.
And if you're going to do it in some place, really, truly, the earth underneath our feet right here is not a bad place to start.
No, it's kind of the cream of the crop
right
here.
Yeah, I mean, we do have the best soil on the planet.
Well, and, you know, that's really important because you look at, you know, they're saying we've lost, you know, half of our topsoil here. Some are even saying the last 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
And you could also say that, you know, that's what I'm interested in the garden is that I started out with a lot of horse manure and things like that. So I had tremendous grain foliage, but not a lot of fruit. And so, you start realizing your soil and the mycelium. I'm very excited by mushrooms and interested in mushrooms. So you realize those mushrooms, that mycelium in the soil is what's growing your food. Right. And another way to look at mushrooms, you know, is they're just like the organisms that live in your stomach that allow you to digest your food. Because without them, you're not going to get very far.
I saw you last week, and you handed me a plant. And I always try to look into new herbs and new things to eat. And I tasted this, and it tasted like anise. You gave me talk about sweet Sicily.
Oh, sweet Sicily. I really like sharing time in the woods with kids. Kids always show me what's going on out there because they'll focus on stuff that I don't give the attention to. And so I try to learn plants so that I can share that plant use with them so that they'll remember the name or something, make some connection. And so sweet Sicily is a great one because, like I say, it's licorice. And most kids know licorice. So And it's they used to use the root. They would dig it up. It's fairly common out there in the timber. And it's a nice, delicate-looking little white umbral flower. And a nice, soft-looking leaf.
And kind of how tall does it grow?
About 2 feet, two and a half feet at the tallest, about
shade,
in there.
Shade, sun?
Shade. You find it more in the shade. Cattle, pretty heavy grazing on it. They like it. So
you get licorice milk then.
Yeah, and I always think of licorice, you know, for your stomach upsetness. And there's a lot of herbal use of licorice.
Sweet Sicily has the qualities of
yes,
licorice
it's actually,
for the digestion.
Yeah, very, very strong.
In the licorice family.
Yeah, very strong. And people used to use it to make candy. I mean, it was used a lot back in the past here in Iowa for cookies and all kinds of things.
Yes, I have a little reference here that says the roots have been used as a cough remedy. And also that anise flavor, good for flavoring cabbage, carrots, parsnips, and fruit dishes. So there you go. Yeah. And Donna, take note of that, because Donna has a very shady yard, and this is the kind of thing that you can kind of grow in the shade. It's a pretty
plant.
Do you
think you could dig some up in the wild and put them?
Sure, they kind of colonize. So you'll find them in kind of groups, and then, you know, you can take some out of each group, and so you won't really affect that. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't take much. It's pretty strong stuff. So if you dig up the root, you know, and you can dry it. I've dried it, put it in stuff. You can slice it up. And
so the root is the only part that you use?
Yeah, pretty much. I try to play around different plants. That's how I remember the names.
Right.
So, but I just chew on the root whenever I'm out in the woods.
So the leaf doesn't have a...
The leaf, okay, now there's two plants that look very, very similar, flower-wise, leaf-wise, height-wise, everything, except that the sweet Sicily has like a dark stem, a very purplish dark skin. And the other is a false sweet Sicily.
Of course.
And it has a green stem.
Okay.
And so it doesn't have any anise or licorice thing quality. So you can easily tell.
Just by tasting.
Just by and you can actually, the piece I gave you, I think I just broke off the top. I didn't even disturb the root. Mm-hmm. I just broke off the
stem.
So the
top has flavor too.
Yeah, not as much. The root really is powerful.
So if you, for example, chopped some leaves into the salad, would it get a little anisey flavor?
I'd probably look into that. But, yeah, I've chewed on the leaf. I don't remember anything.
Wasn't memorable. Okay.
Yeah. So I taste a lot of things and go, well, it didn't affect me, so I guess it was okay.
Forest grazer.
You are listening to KHOI 89.1. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. Welcome back. This is a Donna Lana Kitchen. Donna and I are here with Mark Edwards. We're talking about the earth, Iowa, Iowa underneath us, and all the wonderful things it grows, how we relate to the world around us, the ecology that we are part of. So, Mark, you've been involved a lot in teaching people about the environment and about Iowa. You started the...
Right. Mark has a 30-year career with the DNR. So he's a bit of an expert, or as good as we get. Anyway.
As good as we get. You talk about doing the Trails program and some of the programs you got going, because without that, we couldn't access some of these places.
Right. Well, it started in Ledges. I got my first job because it was right up the road, and there was two facets of that. One, they had received a lot of money in mitigation from building the Sailorville Dam, and they were going to flood the Ledges, and that goes way back. And so one of the compensations was that is to give money to the park to kind of address the bottom part flooding almost every year. And so that – some part of that money went into what they called the Trails Program. And the Trails Program was to – they were going to build this gigantic overlook deck on the ledges there overlooking the river valley. And I knew it to be a Native American site that I had not publicized much about because I was very protective of that. And when I saw they were going to build a deck on top of it, I thought, well, you know, I better get involved. And so – I came and talked to the at that time it was the Conservation Commission about why they shouldn't do this, and ended up finding they had a job opening. And so, like I say, I lived just south of there, a mile and a half. So I said, oh, I'll take the job of building the deck, and we never built the deck. So I felt my career was a success on that level.
That is an interesting way of getting a job.
Good idea.
And from that, I learned, and we had money the first couple of years, and the Ledges was so devastated by overuse. We had, at that point in time, we had about 500,000 people a year coming to that park. So it was going downhill rapidly. I mean, I started out working in foot trails, trying to stabilize those, and they were 6 and 8 feet deep.
Oh, my.
So, I mean, at the time, people just thought they were walking up these ravines, but they were actually had been foot trails and eroded down that far.
Wow.
And so we're back to the reindeer lichen juniper moss colonies that are there, which are so rare. That's why the park was designated. And those colonies were just getting destroyed. So we went back trying to really... And as I said, I build trails to take care of the place, and people are allowed to walk on them. So I'm trying to reduce their impacts is what the trail is. So the trail is more a stabilizing feature.
It's a way to herd the people.
It's a way to herd. And you know, a lot of people like to go fast. So when you make the trail so they can go fast, they go fast and everything. But at that time, you know, it was really sad to go into that park with 500,000 people. And it was, you know, packed. It was crowded. And so there was lots of ramifications.
That's because we need more park space.
Well, yeah, we definitely need more park space. So that expanded rapidly, and I learned that as that money ran out, then I had to write grants. So I started writing grants, and I was extremely successful at writing grants because I would talk about the devastation that I was seeing and that most people couldn't even see. And that seemed to be a very good way to get money. And so I was extremely successful. That's why I branched out and helped start the Water Trails Program. We started the interpretive program.
What's a Water Trails Program?
A Water Trails Program is focusing more on the kayaking, canoeing, fishing, boating, that kind of thing, using the last remnants that are left in Iowa, essentially, which is always the sad part of this. You know, the flip side is always, you know, you want people – the paradox, get out and enjoy it so they'll fall in love with it. And in the same time, we all have impacts. And so in Iowa, which is, you know, the most biologically altered state in North America, we've only got about 1 or 2% left out there with any integrity, and a lot of it is the river courses. And the river courses are critical because they're also the corridors.
Is that because people don't own the rivers? Kind of?
Pretty much. It's kind of like looked at as public. That's you've hit it right on the head. It's public space, and there's very little. Iowa has some of the least amount of public land of all the states.
Oh,
and
dear.
So it's become very critical out there.
What do you think about the this much-praised cleanup of the Iowa River?
You mean like Project Aware or something like that?
Yeah, I mean...
Just
Why just that river?
We started a program called Project Aware, and each year it moves to a different river, and we it happens during the summer months, and hundreds of volunteers show up, and we go up and down those rivers, and, you know, we give education programs, and we, you know, they bring in tons and tons of material of just trash and garbage that are out there. And so it's a good way to get people out there that haven't been out there, and it's also a good illustration of what a mess, how they've been our dumps forever, you know. And so it's, you know, it's a good way to show people about water quality, talk about lots of different things out there that I'm also very scared of, you know, exploitation of these areas as we try and get more and more people out there. So it's that paradox of how do you get people to love a place and not, that's indicative of a lot of our.
You wrote a little bit about in your article on the corn curtain and what's behind us growing all this corn. The fewer and fewer species, bird species, are declining, mainly because they just don't have habitat. You mentioned something called the lesser scalp duck. I've never heard of a lesser scalp duck.
Scob duck is the most common diving duck in North America. Okay, and so it's depends on the organisms that live in the water. And so it cannot migrate across the state of Iowa without losing so much body weight that it can't reproduce, or they actually starve to death because there's so little left of those critters that they eat in the water. So, you know, that's the part we don't see. You know, we can only kind of relate to what we can see on some level, but, you know, I'm trying to give some definition of here's a duck that can't, you know, that can't even get across the state. And that's pretty indicative. I use that as the example of, you know, when you start looking at the importance of connecting up what is left, we have to connect Minnesota and Missouri. That's our role, our east and west with Illinois. Places that have some habitat left, which in Iowa we really don't really have that left. So our job is to somehow in the future be that avenue, be that corridor connecting those things up.
Yeah. And of course, habitat loss does contribute to why some of these animals are not doing very well. But there's some degree that our heavy load of like glyphosate and stuff like that is affecting reproduction. And we can't, you know, the river may look fine, but should we be swimming in it? I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, if you want to be in the water and you want to be out of the chlorine, you're going to be in something else.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think that's a good way of looking at it because we're making trade-offs all the time. And, you know, if we're an agricultural state and we're putting the pesticides, herbicides, all these chemicals, all this continually going off in this direction, you know, we can't expect to have that in our systems. And it's in the air. I think, gosh, back in the 80s or something, I think they did rainwater and they had like 12 different chemicals in the rainwater coming down. So, I mean, it's there. It's part of what we live with.
Well, how is the DNR figuring this into the equation? Are they doing any kind of educational or mitigation or?
Well, I wish I could speak for the DNR. I can't. But I'll tell you, in my lifetime, it's become even a more of a political organization. It's not. It has a hard time following its mission. And, you know, we're spending less and less on it all the time, which is just appalling. I mean, the numbers of people working out there is going down. The budgets are going down.
Well, we did have a wonderful lady on the show that talked about taking the lead out of not using lead in your hunting.
Kay Newman.
Yeah.
I've learned a lot from her. She's very good at giving us the information again about what's happening on the landscape.
And and that seems a very doable thing if you just have everybody switch their ammunition.
Yeah, I found an eagle actually dying from lead poisoning. It's a very gruesome thing to watch.
Sometimes the damage you see seems awfully large. Can you replant a wild area? Can you remake a wild park?
Well, that's a good question because philosophically now there's a discussion about, you know, you can't go back because even the organisms in the soil are changed. So you have to start looking forward. And that's why, you know, I think we need a vision, something to inspire us. And that's why I talk about this connecting Missouri and Minnesota. We need to start looking on a landscape level. And we also need to get down into the conservation ecology level of looking at the health of our soil. So, I mean, it's all levels, vertical and horizontal. And like, say we've gone down this road, we've developed, you know, 98% of Iowa. What are you going to do? Develop the last 2%, and then what are you going to do? I mean, we're at the point where we have to go in a different direction now. We have to. And so that brings up the question of water quality, public lands, the kind of agriculture we're doing, confinements. We could go on and on. I mean, it's exciting time in a way. I mean, in some ways it seems real dark, but in another way it's exciting time because we're going to have to redefine the future here now. And we hopefully we can make choices now that we couldn't have made in the past because we can see we're at a dead
end. It's a little more, it gets more and more obvious, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. I don't know. I think it's...
At least to us, right?
I think it's permeating lots of people. When it comes down to lawsuits over water quality, and then you've got political figures taking sides, you know things are getting bad when things are splitting out into two approaches to the world.
That's true. People get our hackles up over things, but at least we are aware of issues. There's a lot of things we have to talk about, and developing an ethic for how we deal with the land that we live on is maybe the next step in our human evolution.
I hope so.
I hope so, too.
Get some nature hunger going on.
Yeah, there we go.
You're listening to KHOI. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. If you can't get enough of the Donna Lana Kitchen, you can go to the KHOI website. That's KHOIFM.org. Look for the Donna Lana Kitchen page. And find everything you need to know about the past show.
Oh, we've archived it all there.
And there's a recipe or two. And if you want to contact us, give us ideas for shows. Give us some advice. Give us some recipes. Let us know what you think of this show. That's our email address is khoiradio@gmail.com. And kind of indicate Donna Lana Kitchen somewhere in there. And we'd love to hear from you. We'll have a little music here, a little Celtic music, and I love the name of this. This is called Dusty Windowsills. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're here in the studio with Mark Edwards. We're talking about Iowa land. We affect the places that we live, and the places we live affect us a lot, too. There's a lot of...
More than we know.
Yeah, there's some legislation currently. There are some things that we can do collectively.
In the state legislature.
So tell us about that, Mark.
Well, it started a little bit back before the current proposals, and that was the REAP program. More people might be associated with that, the Resource Enhancement and Protection Program. And we started that back in the late 90s there. And it was, if it had been funded, the idea was if it had been fully funded on the front end, it would have lived off the interest pretty much. Well, we didn't do that then. And so now we're trying again to bring some money back into the natural resources. And there's a bill called the National Resources and Outdoor Recreation Trust Fund. And it began in 2010. And 63% of the voters voted that they wanted to see this funded and applied and put into practice. And now they're even saying that that number's probably gone up as we better understand the deteriorating water quality and things. And it was based on an increase of 0.3 cents of sales tax. And that was going to bring in about $180 million annually, and of which, to give you an example, $40 million of that would be directly going to land acquisition and enhancement.
And that means getting more parks?
It could very well be, yeah. We just added a piece up to the Yellow River State Forest up in northeast Iowa, critical national bird area. That was money that came from Audubon and out of REAP and various sources. But, yeah, a critical piece of land that we've been trying to get for 20 years. And so now if there was some kind of funding mechanism in place, we could pick those areas up even quicker.
Good.
So this piece of legislation for a teeny-weeny increase in sales tax is on the agenda today?
Yes, it is. And actually, you should be calling your politician representatives and demanding that they do this because we have to do it at some point. Otherwise, it's just going to get down to real gruesome fights over cleaning your water so you can drink it and things like that. So it has a lot of ramifications.
We're pretty close to that anyway.
Yes, we are.
Well, good. It's good to know there's something we can do. So all those politicians that you elected, make them work for that, work for themselves.
Call Herman Kumbach.
Yes, very good.
Yeah.
Let them know that you have an opinion.
Iowa land is part of all of us, so let's take care of our home ground here, folks. I want to talk about an experiment that I'm doing on my farm. I tend to read a lot of permaculture publications and new ways to farm, new ways to think about things. And I ran across the plant I just couldn't say no to. I gave a chance to this plant. I ordered it from a nursery.
Of course, it's something edible, so we're going to be cooking with it.
It is something edible.
I can hardly wait.
It's berries on a bush, and I've heard that these berries are extremely good for you.
The plant, pictures are lovely, let me tell you.
That always helps. The plant is called sea berry or sea buckthorn.
It has nothing to do with the ocean.
No. Yeah. And nothing to do with – actually, I don't know if it has to do with regular buckthorn either. But anyway, it is a non-native. It is thought to originate in Eastern Europe and Siberia, so it is a hardy sort of thing.
But it does have a lot of vitamin C in it,
yes,
too.
Yes. It's a bushy, thorny little plant, great on hedgerows, little gray leaves, and beautiful little orange berries. The sea berry's Latin name, which is Hypophe – Reminoides means shining horse, and legend has it that Genghis Khan fed his armies sea berries before he entered into battle because these are native to Siberia and northern China. Hardy. They are hardy like down to 50 below zero and actually don't mind bad soil. They need full sun. So I ordered some of these wonderful little thorny bushes.
So we'll be making jelly, maybe?
You can make jelly. You can make juice. They have little orange berries.
Are they very tart, do we think?
We don't know yet. We will grow them and find out.
Oh.
And guess what, folks?
Unknown.
Guess what? Supposedly, this is a nitrogen-fixing plant. More about the...
How virtuous.
More nitrogen-fixing, and the berries are supposed to be very, very high in vitamin C. So for the Genghis Khan on the steppes, it was probably a pretty good thing to be feeding your armies and your horse. So that we'll be I'll keep you up on the process of these berries growing. So I always like to try new things, don't you, Mark?
You bet. Even things that aren't good for me sometimes.
Now, this is supposed to be really good for you. Really good for you, yes. And I got the information from the Seabury book from a book on permaculture called The Resilient Farm and Homestead, It's a man that has set up a permaculture farm in Vermont, of all places. His name is Ben Falk, F-A-L-K. And his farm, he's even growing upland rice there. It's a beautiful book to look at, but he's trying all kinds of things.
Some clever ideas, yeah.
Clever ideas, and really interested in providing a lot of on-the-farm, nutrient-dense foods. So, but he's got all kinds of other things, too. But I thought these sea berries sound like a good idea. And if nothing else, they're clear out there along the fence row, and we're just going to see what they do and see if they can make it through an Iowa winter.
I bet they'll attract deer.
They probably will. But
bright red color.
But the thorns already are pretty little snarly. They're kind of a prickly little hedge here. We'll see. We'll see who gets to the fruit first. It's always good. Well, any more thoughts on taking care of loving the land here?
Well, we got a lot to figure out here, that's for sure. And I hope this conversation continues more and more because we're barely scratching the surface here.
That's true. We'll have you back because we have lots to talk about. That's good. We'll go out with another tune here from the musician, a hammer dulcimer player named Karen Ashbrook, and some other people playing, too. This last tune, these are great names. This last tune is called The Poor Old Woman. I don't know. You just have to relate to these tunes one way to the other. So, you've been listening to The Donna Lana Kitchen with special guest Mark Edwards. Music by Karen Ashbrook and friends. Support this station. We'd love to hear from you. KHOIRadio@gmail.com. We'll get you our email, and you can tell us what you think of this show, what you think of other shows. Send us a recipe. Give us some advice.
Send us some recipes for whatever you got growing in your garden.
Yeah, we'd love to find out what's going on and learn something new. Be part of this community voice. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. I'm Lana Noctical.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
With excellent engineering, as always, by Rick. Eat good food and enjoy life.
All right.